I to give an explanation of your question concerning the nature of evolution.
Number 27. Is evolution, as it is commonly thought of, a fact or something greatly distorted? Apropos of this question, in ESP class 8 days later, Seth had this to say about Charles Darwin and his theory of evolution.
He spent his last years proving it, and yet it has no real validity. It has a validity within very limited perspectives only, for consciousness does indeed evolve form. Form does not evolve consciousness. All consciousness does indeed exist at once, and therefore it did not evolve in those terms. It is according to when you come into the picture, and what you choose to observe, and what part of the play you decide to observe. It is more the other way around, in that evolved consciousness forms itself into many different patterns and rains down on reality. Consciousness did not come from atoms and molecules scattered by chance through the universe, or scattered by chance through many universes. Consciousness did not arrive because inert matter suddenly soared into activity and song. The consciousness existed first and evolved the form into which it then began to manifest itself. Now, if you had all been really paying attention to what I have been saying for some time about the simultaneous nature of time and existence, then you would have known that the theory of evolution is as beautiful a tale as the theory of biblical creation. Both are quite handy, and both are methods of telling stories, and both might seem to agree within their own systems, and yet, in larger respects, they cannot be realities. No. No form of matter, however potent, will be self-evolved into consciousness, no matter what other bits of matter are added to it. Without the consciousness, the matter would not be there in the universe, floating around, waiting for another component to give it reality, consciousness, existence, or song.
A class member. Every bit of matter already has consciousness?
Indeed. And the consciousness came first. You are quite correct. I thank you for bringing up the matter.
Smile.
There are many ways of bringing up matter.
9:30.
At the risk of really repeating myself, let me state that time, as you know it, does not exist basically, and that all creations are simultaneous. That should answer your question.
I've already thought of that, I said. As I told Jane at our first break, the knowledge that time is actually simultaneous is sometimes confounding when one asks certain types of questions. This knowledge half answers the question, yet we want the rest of the question considered.
We will elaborate.
All right.
All of the ages of Earth, in your terms, both past and present, exist as do future ages. Now. You may make that a capital now. Some life forms are being developed in what you think of as present time. They will not appear physically until you reach your future time. Do you follow me?
Yes.
They exist now, however, as certainly as do, say, the dinosaurs. You only choose to focus your attention upon a highly specific field of space-time coordinates, accepting these as present reality and closing yourselves off from all others. Specifically, complicated physical forms are not the result of previous simpler ones. They all exist in larger terms at once. On the other hand, more complicated organizations of consciousness are necessary to form, enter, and vitalize the more complicated physical structures. All structure is formed by consciousness. Defined in your terms, a fragment is a consciousness not as developed as your own. The living portions of nature are the result of your own creativity, projections, and fragments of your own energy. Energy that comes to you from all that is and goes outward from you forming its own image manifestations as you form yours.
Pause at 9:42.
Since you do not perceive the future and do not understand that life goes out in all directions, then it seems only logical to suppose that present forms must be based upon past ones. You do close your eyes to evidence that does not support this theory.
Heartily, smiling.
And of course, I am not speaking of you personally, Joseph. There is no single line development, in other words. The fragment elements directed outward by you as a species also add, of course, to your physical reality. For without the fine balance maintained, and without this cooperation, your particular kind of environment would not be possible. I have told you often that you do yourselves a grave injustice by limiting your conception of the self. Your sense of identity, freedom, power, and love would be immeasurably enhanced if you could understand that what you are does not end at the boundaries of your skin, but continues outward through the physical environment that seems to be impersonal or not self. Biologically, it should be easy to understand that you are physically a part of Earth and everything within it. You are made of the same elements. You breathe the same air. You cannot hold the air that you take within you and then say, "This is myself filled with this air. I will not let it go." Or you would find out very quickly that you were not nearly so independent. You are biologically connected, chemically connected with the earth that you know. But since it is also formed naturally and spontaneously from your own projected psychic energy, since you and the seasons even have a psychic interaction, then the self must be understood in a far greater context. Such a context would allow you to share in life experiences of many other forms, to follow patterns of energy and emotion of which you barely conceive, and to sense a world consciousness in which you have your own independent part. You may take your break.
9:54. I told Jane that she had delivered this excellent answer to my question at a considerably faster pace. Resume at 10:04.
Now, I finished with the last question, so continue.
Number 28. Have I painted any portraits of speakers?
You have indeed. One was a painting purchased by Carl and Sue Watkins,
which, half-jokingly, we had called Moses.
One, the portrait of me.
Pause.
And one that you have not completed, that the dean,
Seth's friendly title for Tom M., one of the members of ESP class,
asked about recently of a woman, and your blue man.
Pause.
That is your answer.
In chapter 17, Seth told Jane and me that we'd both been speakers. Since I haven't painted any self-portraits, I wouldn't have been included in the list anyhow. But Seth did neglect to mention my painting of Jane. I didn't catch the omission, so I didn't ask about it. When Seth tells me I've done a speaker's portrait, I translate this to mean that I've tuned in on but one personality out of the very many making up that speaker's entity. After the sessions began, I started a series of portraits of people I didn't know consciously. At first, I understood little about the possible sources for their inspiration. I simply put my urge to paint them to work. Ideas for the portraits come to me spontaneously when I am mentally occupied with something else. I'm always surprised. Sometimes I see an outright vision, objectified quite clearly and in full color. The vision is either of the finished painting or of the individual who is to be portrayed. On several occasions, I have known the subject was dead. Few of the paintings are of speakers, obviously, and in no case did I realize I was working with such a personality. I recently finished the blue man that Seth refers to. I painted a male in modern garb, but in reality, according to an amused Seth, the subject was a female clairvoyant who lived in Constantinople in the 14th century. Unconscious distortions in my own perceptions led me to the male figure. Seth has given her the name Ayano Diala. The oil is very successful and is done in blue and green. Such sources of inspirational material were entirely unsuspected by me in earlier years. I believe now that they are among those usually present at unconscious levels. But in order to expand the potentials for the creative act as much as possible, I would like to see others learn to cultivate such visions and perceptions on a deliberate conscious basis. It seems to me the benefits would be many. There is much to be learned here. Do you want to deal now with the question about the Dead Sea Scrolls and Yehoshua? This was in reference to a letter Jane had received on April 12th, having to do with Seth's third Christ data in the Seth material.
We will save that for our religious chapter. In it, we will answer your other related questions.
Well, number 52. In the 429th session for August 14th, 1968, you said, "Also, minutes and hours have their own consciousness." You didn't elaborate. Smile.
And now you want me to elaborate.
Well, I don't know. I'm wondering if perhaps the question is too complicated for a quick answer.
Give us a moment.
Pause.
What you perceive of time is a portion of other events intruding into your own system, often interpreted as movement in space, or as something that separates events, if not in space, then in a way impossible to define without using the concept of time. What separates events is not time, but your perception. You perceive events one at a time. Time, as it appears to you, is instead a psychic organization of experience. The seeming beginning and end of an event, the seeming birth and death, are simply other dimensions of experience as, for example, height, width, weight. Instead, it seems to you that you grow toward an end, when an end is a part of a particular experience, or if you prefer, person event.
1026.
We are speaking then of multidimensional reality. The whole self or entity or soul can never be completely materialized in three-dimensional form. A part of it can be projected into that dimension, however, extending so many years in time, taking up so much space, and so forth. The entity sees the whole event, the whole person event, with the time element, or age in your terms, as simply another characteristic or dimension. The person event is not cut off, however. Its greater reality simply cannot appear within three dimensions. It is instead composed of atoms and molecules that you do not perceive, both above and below the physical range of intensities, and all of these in their own way possess consciousness. In greater terms, seconds and moments do not exist either, but the reality that is behind time, or that you perceive as time, the outside time events, are composed of units that also have their own kind of consciousness. They form what appears as time to you, as atoms and molecules form what appears as space to you.
Pause.
Now these are units moving faster than the speed of light, excellent energy sources intruding into and impinging upon matter without ever materializing. They will be interpreted differently in other systems. That is the end.
Smiling. 1035. Of book dictation, that is, this was actually a break. Seth finished the session with several pages of material dealing with other matters, and at 11:16 p.m. Session 583, April 21st, 1971, 9:30 p.m. Wednesday. Last night, Tuesday, I went to bed while Jane was holding ESP class in the living room. It was about 11:30. As I lay dozing, I gave myself suggestions that I would recall my dreams in the morning and write them down. Oddly enough, I didn't mention astral projection. I slept rather uneasily, waking up several times while class was still in progress. Finally, I was hazily aware of hearing the cars of class members as they pulled out of the parking lot next to the house. Then I slept. Jane said later that she came to bed at 12:45 a.m. The next thing I knew, I was hovering in the air in our darkened bathroom. I was in a bodiless state without being at all upset. The bathroom is in the center of our apartment. The living room is on one side of it, the bedroom and my studio on the other. In order to keep our cat Willie off our bed at night, we put him in the living room and closed the door on that side of the bathroom. Now I found myself hanging in front of that door, unable to penetrate it. I felt no panic, no fear. My astral eyes were functioning. A weak light came through a narrow open window to my right. The closed door was in deep shadow, but I knew I was before it. Although my body lay sleeping beside Jane in the bedroom behind me, I wasn't concerned about it. I didn't realize that I was projecting at first. I didn't have the presence of mind, say, to order myself to burst through the door into the living room. But that I was out of my body and in this very pleasant weightless state did slowly make itself known to me. I had no memory of actually leaving my body and moving into the bathroom. This was the first time that no element of fear was present in any of my rather infrequent projections. I believe my ordinary conscious ideas that doors can't be penetrated held me back, though. I fell asleep again briefly after encountering the impasse posed by the closed door. When I became aware again, evidently a few moments later, I found myself floating just above my physical body as it lay in bed. It happened that I lay sleeping flat on my back with my arms down at my sides. My astral body was in the same approximate position, perhaps 6 inches above. My state was remarkably steady and pleasant. I felt awake, aware of what I was up to, and quite free and weightless. I heard myself snoring, without paying much attention to that fact yet. I knew I wasn't dreaming. I even remembered reading at various times that when projecting, one knows the difference between that state and a dreaming one. This I could now attest to at first hand. I was very pleased. I had a different kind of vision this time. In some fashion, I was aware of my legs especially, suspended above my physical ones. I took great pleasure in wiggling them about, shaking them up and down, enjoying the marvelous sense of freedom and lightness they possessed. I knew my physical legs couldn't move that freely, although they are in good shape. My astral legs felt quite rubbery, so loose and flexible were they, and somehow, from my prone position, I could see that they were light-colored and translucent from the knees down. Since my projection state seemed to be so reliable, I began to think it offered great opportunities. I felt no fear again, only confidence. I thought that this would be a great time to do something. Now was the time for a fine adventure. I told myself I was willing to try anything. A visit to some other reality, a plunge through the door into the living room, a trip down the street in front of the house. All this time, Jane lay beside me. She said afterward that I was snoring loudly when she came to bed. My attention now began to change its focus. For the first time, I really heard myself. I was amazed at the loudness of the sounds that came from my physical head just beneath me. I couldn't possibly duplicate them while awake. Without success, I made several quite conscious and deliberate attempts to get going and travel away from my body. My efforts didn't break the projection spell. I merely remained hovering where I was. Then I had an idea. I would use the sound of my snoring as an impetus to send myself soaring off into other dimensions, leaving my body far behind me on the bed. Deliberately, I began to snore even louder, if possible. I wanted to build up a massive sound impetus that I would use as a propellant, although I didn't know how this was supposed to work. The strange thing is, I enjoyed both the feeling of lying just above my physical body and my ability to use the latter to produce sound. This implies a dual consciousness here, since I was aware of both bodies. Either I heard my snoring actually increase in volume, or I focused upon it even more acutely. My idea wasn't working anyhow. I don't know whether I would have eventually succeeded in taking off, for Jane now said to me, "Honey, you're snoring, turn over," as she usually does when she gets tired of listening to me. I heard her clearly. I stopped snoring at once, but didn't move. I don't remember rejoining my physical body. Finally, I nudged her, and with an effort told her something of what had transpired. She thought I sounded as though I was still in a trance. It felt as though I might project again, so I kept trying while Jane lay quietly beside me. I had no success, although the very pleasant aura surrounding the whole episode lingered most definitely. The projection, small as it was, had seemed so easy and natural that I wondered why it wasn't a commonplace. I knew all the while that much more was possible than I was able to accomplish, that just beyond my abilities of the moment lay wonderful possibilities if I could just break that barrier. I never did feel any alarm, and at no time did I see or feel the astral silver cord. Finally, I slept. The experience gave rise to a couple of questions, which I added to the list for Chapter 20. 1. My own projection was so enjoyable, but more importantly contained so many potentials, that I wonder why Western man isn't more aware of these abilities. 2. Why doesn't he cultivate them and put them to use? I hoped Seth would comment tonight.
Now, good evening.
Good evening, Seth.
And congratulations.
Thank you.
This is to you. You tried the experiment when you did, having an ace in the hole, so to speak, in case you became frightened, knowing full well that Rupert would be coming to bed. You were ready to try again, however, and picked a slow and easy method, pleasant surroundings to make it easy for you also, so that you could become familiar with the sensation before you actually did anything too adventurous with it.
Did I try this before Jane came to bed?
No. You began your attempts before, but did not succeed until Rupert came to bed. The time sense outside the body can be quite different than the body's. You knew that with one successful experience you would be much more free, and so you chose the best of circumstances. You could have left the apartment indeed. The snoring was also, however, supposed to be a signal to Rupert. You knew he would awaken you. This was the original motivation for it. If you did not like the experiment, you see, it would have been terminated. In the meantime, however, you were delighted and decided upon the noise as a propellant, but Rupert's usual reaction to the snoring took place. You should find yourself remembering quite a few such experiences now.
It is Sunday, April 25th, as I type up this session from my notes. Ever since April 21st, I have been waiting expectantly and in vain for another projection. On a different occasion, I had a rather small out-of-body that trailed behind it for almost 2 weeks, a series of incomplete projections or dream experiences containing distorted elements of such phenomena. Strangely, An analogy might be the aftershocks following a quake.
Now, in answer to your questions, Western man has chosen to focus his energy outward and largely ignore inner realities. The social and cultural aspects, and even the religious ones, automatically inhibit such experiences from childhood on. There is no social benefit at all connected with projections in your society and many taboos against it.
940.
This is, of course, chosen by those involved in that civilization. There are also balances that exist before moderation and understanding are reached. Some personalities choose to be reincarnated in exteriorly oriented societies in compensation for lives that were lived with great concentration inward and very poor physical manipulation. Man learns, you see, that inner reality and outer reality both must be understood and used constructively. Projections occur, of course, in the sleep state constantly, whether or not they are remembered. They are recalled when there is some reason to do so, some merit or obvious achievement involved, as in societies where it is considered highly advantageous to use dreams and projections. If you are presently experiencing a life in which you have chosen high emphasis upon physical locomotion, for example, then through vague dream memories of flying, you can be inspired toward, say, the invention of airplanes or rockets. But if you actually understand the fact that your own consciousness can indeed travel outside of the body, then the impetus toward physical developments in locomotion is not nearly so intense. Now, what questions do you have?
Number 53. In the 429th session for August 14th, 1968, you said that some personalities can be a part of more than one entity.
I have mentioned this many times. There are no boundaries to the self and no barriers put upon its development. A personality may originally be a part of a given entity and on its own develop interests quite different. It can, on its own, take a lonely way, or it can instead attach itself or gravitate toward other entities with interests like its own. The original connection will not be severed, but new ones made and formed.
Pause at 947. Number 46. In Chapter 19 of the Seth material, you gave a list of the inner senses. Are there more of these that you haven't told us about?
There are indeed. They have to do, however, with experiences that you will not normally encounter in your particular system, that lie latent. Almost any cell has the capacity for growing into any given organ or forming any part of the body. It has the capacity for developing sense organs that, practically speaking, will not be developed if the cell becomes an elbow or a knee, but the capacity is there. This applies not only to your own species, but in many cases between species, and there are basic units in all living matter capable of forming animal or vegetable life, capable of developing the perceptive mechanisms inherent in any of these. It is therefore theoretically possible for you to see the world through a frog's eye, or a bird's, or an ant's. We are speaking here of physical senses. The inner self has also latent inner senses beside the ones that it normally uses while the consciousness is tuned into a particular camouflage system. Some, however, are inexpressible in physical terms, and only analogies could be used to hint of their nature. In this book, there is no need to discuss them. They belong in a book given more specifically to interior methods of perception.
Number 55. This question comes from the answer you gave to number 11 when I asked you about the training Jane would need in order to deliver one of the ancient speaker manuscripts. You said some of those old languages involved pictures and symbols. With your help, while she's in trance, Could Jane make drawings of a few picture words or symbols? I'm just curious to see if she could approximate one of the speaker languages.
This is possible.
That would be very interesting. Seth paused, so I asked, can she try it now?
This is not the time.
Pause.
There are many distorted interconnections between these. Some hieroglyphics and the symbols were used by the Mu civilization. I suggest a break then while you check your questions.
Okay. 10 o'clock. Jane and I went over some of the remaining questions, but since she seemed to be tiring, I suggested we end this part of the session. The rest of it was given over to personal material, and at 10:58 p.m. Session 584, May 3rd, 1971, 9:35 p.m., Monday. Except for ESP class, Jane rested from psychic work last week.
Now, good evening.
Good evening, Seth.
I will answer questions that do not deal with reincarnation or religion.
We had been talking about those subjects just before the session, although I hadn't planned to refer to them tonight. Number 58. Are there any more laws of the inner universe other than those you gave in the 50th session for May 4th, 1964?
There are, but since I am not covering those in this book, I will give them to you at another time.
I asked the question because I thought Seth's answer to number 46 in the last session touched upon one of those proportions. The law of infinite changeability and transmutation. In view of his reply now, though, I didn't pursue the matter further. Number 44. If you hadn't been able to speak through Jane, would you try to do so through another, or are you doing so anyhow?
I have spoken through others. The arrangements this time were already made, you see. It is true that Rupert need not have accepted the arrangement. If so, the material would have been given, but in a different fashion. I would not have spoken in this way. For this work requires a certain specific rapport and definite characteristics on the part of the personality involved. Material could have been given in a much more simple fashion through another, but I wanted it as undistorted and fully dimensional as possible. Had Rupert not been available, the material would have been given to a speaker, living in your terms, who was also involved in the creative field. There is no one else presently alive in your system with whom I had any great rapport in the past except yourselves. Such a speaker would have received the information largely in the dream state and written it in a series both of treatises and fictionalized narrative. Had Rupert not accepted, however, it is most probable that he would have chosen another life in which to fulfill the task, in which case I would have waited. The decision was always his, however, and had he not accepted at all, other arrangements would have been made.
To me.
Now you early foresaw your part in these sessions and our work. One of the paintings you did many years ago clearly foreshadowed the development of your psychic endeavors. This was the one you sold, of the man, that hung for some time in the position in which my portrait now hangs. That was a portrait of Joseph. In other words, of your own inner identity as you intuitively perceived it at the time. You were not consciously aware of the connection, but you were consciously aware of the painting's strong impact.
I know the painting, of course. I painted it in Florida in 1954 before Jane and I were married. I have photographs of it and intend to repaint it someday. This means, of course, that I'll only be painting a new version of the old. It would be impossible to truly duplicate it. I have no regrets about selling the painting, though.
It represented also the searching, creatively dissatisfied portion of you, looking for further understanding and knowledge. The peculiar relationship existing between you and Rupert was also a prerequisite, and so your permission and acceptance was also needed. Had you remained apart, the sessions would not have begun. You have been connected with the same entity, though you have sprung apart from it, but the inner relationship adds to the power available. You help steady the circuit, so to speak. You also generated initial energy and impetus to help Rupert's own. Such work does not only necessitate the choosing of one individual, but is also an endeavor in which many other elements are taken into consideration. It was known, for example, that Rupert would need your support, as it was also known that the work itself would help your own creative abilities. All of this was decided by you both, and by me before you began this particular lifetime. Even Rupert's intellectual questioning and often deep reluctance was known in advance and adapted to aid in the work involved. The information was not to be given to born believers, but to intelligent people and to a medium who questioned it, not only for himself, but for all those given to the same kind of questioning. As Rupert grows to understand, therefore, and as he continues to develop, he triumphs not only for himself, but for all those who follow his ventures. And yet, we wanted a balance also. And so you stand as a man who intuitively recognized the value of inner information and the importance of the material, even though you were unacquainted with such ideas.
10 o'clock.
It goes without saying that on much deeper levels there is no reluctance on Rupert's part, or the abilities would not have developed in this fashion. His criticism in the beginning served also as reassurance to the ego in its first experiences that it would not be shoved aside or damaged in any fashion. The characteristics needed for mediumship are much like those needed by any strongly creative person. A strong, supportive ego is a necessity, particularly in initial stages. In periods of severe personality disturbances that can occur simultaneously with great creativity, the ego becomes terrified of the strength of the creative ability, fearing that it can be crushed beneath. In such cases, the ego is too rigid and does not expand with the nature of the personality's whole creative experience. Of course, this could happen with mediumship, as with any other such activity. In this case, however, Rupert's ego gradually began to let its rigidity go in a gradual process that allowed the whole personality, itself included, to expand. End of dictation for now. And a personal note. You can see where the above information ties in with Rupert. The idea of letting the muscular armor go, as in your current reading, is good. You can take your break, and then we will resume the session.
10:09. Jane's trance had been deep, her delivery fast. She said she could see the 1954 painting very clearly while Seth talked about it, including its wide, old-fashioned gold frame. At first, she had forgotten what the frame looked like, she told me, but now she correctly described it. Naturally, the painting was sold before we had any conscious awareness of its import. This would be not only before the sessions began, but before we even suspected such possibilities. The balance of the session is deleted from the record. End at 10:28 p.m. Seth Speaks by Jane Roberts. Copyrighted material. All rights reserved.
Chapter 21. The Meaning of Religion.
Session 585, May 12, 1971, 9:35 p.m., Wednesday. Before the session, Jane and I went over the questions remaining on the list we had prepared for Chapter 20. I hope Seth will just do those chapters on religion and reincarnation and get them over with, she said. We've realized for some time that Jane is sensitive to those subjects, particularly religion. She had strict training in that field as a youngster. Coupled with that, however, she developed a very strong, literal, religious drive on her own. She is well aware that such an early environment leaves its marks, even though she had left her church by the time she was 19. Somewhat to my surprise, Seth started chapter 21 this evening, but I soon realized that he wasn't leaving our questions behind. The session was held in my studio again, and because of its rather small size, Jane decided not to smoke. It had been raining all day, and still was.
Good evening.
Good evening, Seth.
Now, the questions on religion and reincarnation will be answered in due time, as mentioned. I will deal with several of your other questions also along with the text. Therefore, we will begin the next chapter, called The Meaning of Religion. There are internal realizations always present within the whole self. There is comprehension of the meaning of all existence within each personality. The knowledge of multidimensional existence is not only in the background of your present conscious activity, but each man knows within himself that his conscious life is dependent upon a greater dimension of actuality. This greater dimension cannot be materialized in a three-dimensional system, yet the knowledge of this greater dimension floods outward from the innermost heart of being and is projected outward, transforming all it touches. This flooding out imbues certain elements of the physical world with a brilliance and intensity far surpassing that usually known. Those touched by it are transformed, in your terms, into something more than they were. This inner knowledge attempts to find a place for itself within the physical landscape, to translate itself into physical terms. Each man, then, possesses this inner knowledge within himself, and to some extent or other, he also looks for confirmation of it in the world.
Pause at 9:45. The above paragraph is, incidentally, an excellent little description of the results flowing from Jane's own psychic initiation in September 1963. Her transcendent experience led to her manuscript, The Physical Universe as Idea Construction, which in turn led to these sessions. See her introduction to this book. A note. I was amused now to see Jane light a cigarette while she was in trance.
The outer world is a reflection of the inner one, though far from perfect. The inner knowledge can be compared to a book about a homeland that a traveler takes with him into a strange country. Each man is born with the yearning to make these truths real for himself, though he sees a great difference between them and the environment in which he lives. An internal drama is carried on by each individual, a psychic drama which is finally projected outward with great force upon the field of history. The birth of great religious events emerges from the interior religious drama. The drama itself is a psychological phenomenon in a way, for each physically oriented self feels thrust alone into a strange environment, without knowing its origins or destination, or even the reason for its own existence. This is the dilemma of the ego, particularly in its early states. It looks outward for answers because this is its nature, to manipulate within physical reality. It also senses, however, a deep and abiding connection that it does not understand, with other portions of the self that are not under its domain. It is also aware that this inner self possesses knowledge upon which its own existence is based. As it grows, in your terms, it looks outward for confirmation of this inner knowledge. The inner self upholds the ego with its support. It forms its truths into physically oriented data with which the ego can deal. It then projects these outward into the area of physical reality. Seeing these truths thus materialized, the ego then finds it easier to accept them. Thus, you deal often with events in which men are touched by great illumination, isolated from the masses of humanity, and endowed with great powers. Periods of history that appear almost unnaturally brilliant in contrast with others. Prophets, geniuses, and kings shown in greater than human proportion.
10 o'clock.
Now, these people are chosen by others to manifest outwardly the interior truths that all intuitively know. There are many levels of significance here. On the one hand, such individuals receive their unearthly abilities and power from their fellows, contain it, exhibit it in the physical world for all to see. They play the part of the blessed inner self that actually cannot operate within physical reality uncloaked by flesh. This energy, however, is a quite valid projection from the interior self.
Long pause.
The personality so touched by it actually does then become, in certain terms, what he seems to be. He will emerge as an eternal hero in the external religious drama, as the inner self is the eternal hero of the interior religious drama.
10:08.
This mystic projection is a continual activity. When the strength of one great religion begins to diminish and its physical effects grow less, then the internal drama begins once again to quicken. The highest of man's aspirations, therefore, will be projected upon physical history. The dramas themselves will differ. Remember, they are built up internally first. They will be formed to impress world conditions at any given time, and therefore couched in symbols and events that will most impress the populace. This is craftily done. For the inner self knows exactly what will impress the ego and what kinds of personalities will be best able to personify the message at any given time. When such a personality appears in history, then, he is intuitively recognized. For the way has long been laid, and in many cases the prophecies announcing such an arrival have already been given. The individuals so chosen do not just happen to appear among you. They are not chosen at random. They are individuals who have taken upon themselves the responsibility for this role. After their birth, they are aware to varying degrees of their destiny, and certain trigger experiences may at times arouse their full memory. They serve, quite clearly, as human representatives of all that is. Now, since each individual is a part of all that is, to some extent, each of you serve in that same role. In such a religious drama, however,
long pause.
The main personality is much more conscious of his inner knowledge, more aware of his abilities, far better able to use them, and exultantly familiar with his relationship to all of life. Now you may take your break.
10:25. Following break, Seth Jane delivered 5 excellent pages of data about my painting and related subjects. The session ended at 11:03 p.m. Jane, knowing Seth had started his chapter on religion, was both relieved and very curious. I finally ended up giving her a copy of the material in order to answer all of her questions. She liked it so much that she read it to ESP class, as she has done with a few previous segments from the book. Session 586, July 24th, 1971, 9:01 p.m. Saturday. This is the first regular session since May 12th. There were many factors behind the long layoff: Jane's sheer need for rest, problems and questions of our own that we had wanted to deal with, but had put off for a long time. Some work with others, a vacation, and the acquisition of several more rooms across the hall from our original apartment. Jane held ESP classes for some of this time, though, and gave a few sessions within that format. Jane preferred that Seth simply start in where he had left off on the chapter, a feat I was sure he was capable of. "But I don't care what he does," she laughed, "as long as we have a session." She was somewhat nervous because of the break in dictation, in spite of my reassurances. She was strongly interested in seeing that Seth finished his book, although she still has to read most of it. The session was held in our old bedroom, which, having been cleared out now, is an adjunct to my studio. The additional space we've acquired is most welcome.
"Now, good evening."
"Good evening, Seth." Smiling.
"And welcome back. Now give me a moment, and we will begin by resuming our chapter on religion."
Pause.
"Ideas of good and evil, gods and devils, salvation and damnation, are merely symbols of deeper religious values. Cosmic values, if you will, that cannot be translated into physical terms. These ideas become the driving themes of these religious dramas of which I have spoken. The actors may return time and time again in different roles. In any given historic religious drama, therefore, the actors may have already appeared on the historic scene in your past, the prophet of today being the traitor of the past drama. These psychic entities are real, however. It is quite true to say that their reality consists not only of the core of their own identity, but also is reinforced by those projected thoughts and feelings of the earthly audience for whom the drama is enacted.
905.
Psychic or psychological identification is of great import here, and is indeed at the heart of all such dramas. In one sense, you can say that man identifies with the gods he has himself created. Man does not understand the magnificent quality of his own inventiveness and creative power, however. Then, say that gods and men create each other, and you come even closer to the truth. But only if you are very careful in your definitions, for how exactly do gods and men differ? The attributes of the gods are those inherent within man himself, magnified, brought into powerful activity. Men believe that the gods live forever. Men live forever, but having forgotten this, they remember only to endow their gods with this characteristic. Obviously, then, beyond these earthly historic religious dramas, the seemingly recurring tales of gods and men, there are spiritual realities.
910.
Behind the actors in the dramas, there are more powerful entities who are quite beyond role-playing. The plays themselves, then, the religions that sweep across the ages, these are merely shadows, though helpful ones. Behind the frame of good and evil is a far deeper spiritual value. All religions, therefore, while trying to catch truth, must to some large degree fear its ever eluding them. The inner self alone, at rest, in meditation, can at times glimpse portions of these inner realities that cannot be physically expressed. These values, intuitions, or insights are given each to each according to his understanding, and so the stories told about them will often vary. For example, the main character in a religious historical drama may or may not consciously be aware of the ways in which such information is given to him. And yet, it may seem to him that he does know, for the nature of a dogma's origin will be explained in terms that this main character can understand. The historical Jesus knew who he was. But he also knew that he was one of three personalities composing one entity. To a large extent, he shared in the memory of the other two. The third personality, mentioned many times by me, has not, in your terms, yet appeared, although his existence has been prophesied as the second coming.
Matthew 24.
Now, these prophecies were given in terms of the current culture at that time, and therefore, while the stage has been set, the distortions are deplorable. For this Christ will not come at the end of your world, as the prophecies have been maintaining.
9:20.
He will not come to reward the righteous and send evildoers to eternal doom. He will, however, begin a new religious drama. A certain historical continuity will be maintained. As happened once before, however, he will not be generally known for who he is. There will be no glorious proclamation to which the whole world will bow. He will return to straighten out Christianity, which will be in a shambles at the time of his arrival, and to set up a new system of thought when the world is sorely in need of one.
9:25.
By that time, all religions will be in severe crisis. He will undermine religious organizations, not unite them. His message will be that of the individual in relation to all that is. He will clearly state methods by which each individual can attain a state of intimate contact with his own entity, the entity to some extent being man's mediator with all that is. By 2075, all of this will be already accomplished. You may make note here that Nostradamus saw the dissolution of the Roman Catholic Church as the end of the world. He could not imagine civilization without it. Hence, many of his later predictions should be read with this in mind. The third personality of Christ will indeed be known as a great psychic, for it is he who will teach humanity to use those inner senses that alone make true spirituality possible. Slayers and victims will change roles as reincarnational memories rise to the surface of consciousness. Through the development of these abilities, the sacredness of all life will be intimately recognized and appreciated. Now, there will be several born before that time who in various ways will re-arouse man's expectations. One such man has already been born in India, in a small province near Calcutta, but his ministry will seem to remain comparatively local for his lifetime. Another will be born in Africa, a black man whose main work will be done in Indonesia. The expectations were set long ago in your terms, and will be fed by new prophets until the third personality of Christ does indeed emerge. He will lead man behind the symbolism upon which religion has relied for so many centuries. He will emphasize individual spiritual experience, the expansiveness of soul, and teach man to recognize the multitudinous aspects of his own reality. Now you may take your break.
Thank you. 9:37. Seth spoke humorously about break, since the pace had been mostly fast with few pauses. Jane's trance had been good. I had to work harder than usual taking notes because I was out of practice. I also discovered I'd temporarily forgotten some of the symbols I use in my own version of speed writing. During the break, Jane read over parts of Chapter 18 of the Seth material, then announced that she thought there was a contradiction between that material, originally from the 491st session on July 2, 1969, on the three Christs, and the information given by Seth this evening. Here are the paragraphs in question from pages 246 to 247 of the chapter on the God concept.
There were three men whose lives became confused in history and merged, and whose composite history became known as the life of Christ. Each was highly gifted psychically, knew of his role, and accepted it willingly. The three men were a part of one entity, gaining physical existence in one time. They were not born on the same date, however. There are reasons why the entity did not return as one person. For one thing, the full consciousness of an entity would be too strong for one physical vehicle. For another, the entity wanted a more diversified environment than could otherwise be provided. The entity was born once as John the Baptist, and then he was born in two other forms. One of these contained the personality that most stories of Christ refer to. I will tell you about the other personality at a later time. There was constant communication between these three portions of one entity, though they were born and buried at different dates. The race called up these personalities from its own psychic bank, from the pool of individualized consciousness that was available to it.
I, too, had begun wondering. All along, we'd been thinking the three personalities making up the Christ entity had already lived and died. But now here, Seth was talking about the third personality returning in the next century. What was the explanation? We weren't upset, yet we did feel uneasy as the session resumed at 9:57.
Now, let us resume. The third historical personage, already born in your terms, and a portion of the entire Christ personality, took upon himself the role of a zealot. This person had superior energy and power and great organizing abilities, but it was the errors that he made unwittingly that perpetuated some dangerous distortions. The records of that historical period are scattered and contradictory. The man, historically now, was Paul, or Saul. It was given to him to set up a framework, but it was to be a framework of ideas, not of regulations, of men, not of groups. Here he fell down, and he will return as the third personality just mentioned in your future. In that respect, however, there are not four personalities.
I understand.
Now, Saul went to great lengths to set himself as a separate identity. His characteristics, for example, were seemingly quite different from those of the historical Christ. He was converted in an intense personal experience, a fact that was meant to impress upon him the personal and not organizational aspects. Yet some exploits of his in his earlier life had been attributed to Christ, not as a young man, but earlier.
10:05.
All personalities have free will and work out their own challenges. The same applied to Saul. The organizational distortions, however, were also necessary within the framework of history as events are understood. Saul's tendencies were known, therefore, at another level. They served a purpose. It is for this reason, however, that he will emerge once again, this time to destroy those distortions. Now, he did not create them on his own and thrust them upon historical reality.
Jane paused, a hand to her eyes.
He created them insofar as he found himself forced to admit certain facts. In that world at that time, earthly power was needed to hold Christian ideas apart from numberless other theories and religions, to maintain them in the middle of warring factions. It was his job to form a physical framework, and even then he was afraid that the framework would strangle the ideas, but he saw no other way.
Why the two names, Paul and Saul?
He was called both.
Pause.
When the third personality reemerges historically, however, he will not be called the old Paul, but will carry within him the characteristics of all the three personalities.
Jane paused again. Can I ask a very stupid question?
You may.
There followed a short exchange between Seth and me, which isn't recorded verbatim because it was too rapid. I was interested in learning whether and when the three personalities of the Christ entity had met as physical beings. It seemed that superior psychic interactions would have taken place among them, and I wanted to know more about this. Jane, as Seth, listened politely to my groping questions.
It is easy to see that you have no knowledge of the Bible.
True.
For this would be fairly apparent to those who have. Paul tried to deny knowing who he was until his experience with conversion. Allegorically, he represented a warring faction of the self that fights against his own knowledge and is oriented in a highly physical manner. It seemed he went from one extreme to another, being against Christ and then for him. But the inner vehemence was always present, the inner fire, and the recognition that he tried for so long to hide. His was the portion that was to deal with physical reality and manipulation, and so these qualities were strong in him. To some extent, they overruled him. When the historical Christ died, Paul was to implement the spiritual ideas in physical terms to carry on. In so doing, however, he grew the seeds of an organization that would smother the ideas. He lingered after Christ, just as John the Baptist came before. Together, the three spanned some time period, you see. John and the historical Christ each performed their roles and were satisfied that they had done so. Paul alone was left at the end unsatisfied. And so it is about his personality that the future Christ will form. The entity of which these personalities are part, that entity which you may call the Christ entity, was aware of these issues. The earthly personalities were not aware of them, although in periods of trance and exaltation much was made known to them. Paul also represented the militant nature of man that had to be taken into consideration in line with man's development at the time. That militant quality in man will completely change its nature and be dispensed with, as you know it, when the next Christ personality emerges. It is therefore appropriate that Paul be present.
10:27.
In the next century, the inner nature of man with these developments will free itself from many constraints that have bound it. A new era will indeed begin. Not now a heaven on earth, but a far more sane and just world, in which man is far more aware of his relationship with his planet and of his freedom within time. Now you may take a break in time.
10:30. Jane's pace had been good again for the most part, but she came out of trance easily. She was relieved that Seth had named the third personality of the Christ entity. Although she said she hadn't been worrying about this data, I knew she had been more than usually concerned about getting it. Our discussion at break concerned several other points I thought readers might be interested in. One was the zealot designation Seth applied to Paul. At first, I'd thought he was going to say there was a connection between Paul, or Saul, and the Zealots, one of the religious sects the Jewish people had been divided into in Judea in the first century A.D. The Holy Land was occupied by the Romans then, and Paul was a Jew and a Roman citizen. I'd been reading about these sects recently in a book on the Dead Sea Scrolls, and had been somewhat puzzled by my interest in both the scrolls and the sects. But after hearing Seth tonight, I assumed he wasn't going to say much about these subjects. Another question concerned a name and country for the appearance of the third Christ in the next century. Also, could or would Seth give any data on the religious figure already born in India and the black man to be born in Africa? As we continued to talk during break, Jane then told me she knew the answers to the questions I had asked. The answers had come to her. She didn't get this information in exact words, she said, but felt it and had to translate it. 1. Seth had intended the word zealot, as applied to Paul, to be descriptive of his temperament, not a reference to the zealot sect. A note added later, More was to come on Paul and the Zealots, though. 2. The country, with a name and dates, which would see the appearance of the third Christ in the next century, would not be given to us now, but might be in later years. Seth, she said, had deliberately refrained from being more specific.